Genesis chapter 1:1. I think you probably know that quite well. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. I'm going to talk about that today. This message is actually to be considered a continuation of last week's message that took on the topic of exploring evidence for the existence of God, particularly through examining the idea of the finely tuned universe. Remember all the different parameters and I spoke about five of just 40 different ones that we could have talked about how our universe is set up so that life can exist. And if we tried to put a number on that and the chances of that actually happening, it's so astronomical that I wouldn't be able to even say that number. We also talked about the idea of the irreducible complexity of biological systems that says that for the system to work, all the parts have to be there to begin with. Even Darwin, even Darwin concluded that if it could somehow be demonstrated that any complex organ, say your eye for example, existed which could not possibly have been formed by numerous successive slight modifications, my theory would absolutely break down, he said. And this idea of the irreducible complexity of biological systems, that kind of has that. We looked at the little flagellum on a bacterial cell that has, if you get down at the microscopic level, you can see all the small little parts that need to come together to make that flagellum work. Take one of those parts away and it ceases to do its function. So we talked about that last week, and in the end we concluded that really theism, a belief in the supernatural creator, it's the most reasonable worldview to hold. We also looked at pantheism and atheism. And we see that even as science advances into the 21st century, the evidence of God keeps mounting. And so we can agree totally with what David, the psalmist, said in Psalm 19, the heavens and the earth declare the glory of God. And so here today I'm going to continue on in my discussion of that. And our conversation today is focused on evidence from science and philosophy that argue for the beginning of the universe. That our universe actually had a beginning. Now you might be asking yourself, why is knowing that the universe has a beginning, how is that going to be important to my belief in God? Well, the point here is that without a beginning, one could, and they have already done this, postulated the idea that the universe is eternal and infinite. That's what some physicists and astronomers are saying. That the universe had no beginning or end. And from this, one can extrapolate out and say that since the universe has always been here, then, in fact, there is no need for a supernatural creator. There's no need for God. An infinite universe, a universe that has no beginning or no end, really has no need for a creator. You see, the world is always trying to conveniently give us a theory or something that can eliminate God. That's what they want to do. You know, for centuries, mankind has grappled with the idea of an infinite past and the question of whether there was a beginning to the universe, and that question, is there a beginning to the universe? Ancient Greek philosophers believed that matter was necessary, and it was uncreated, and therefore it was eternal. In their view, the god or the gods, they may have been responsible for somehow organizing the cosmos, organizing the matter, but he or she or they, whatever they want to call their god, they did not create the universe itself. This is the Greek idea. Now, the Greek idea has overflowed into Western civilization. We always look to the Romans and the Greeks and we say, oh, you know, they had such wonderful cultures and this is what our culture is built on. And if that's the truth, well, you know, our culture is really, you know, I can't say it's that. I mean, there's some good things, obviously, but I get off the topic here, though. The Greek view directly contrasted with an even more ancient view, and that was the Jewish thought about this subject at the beginning of the universe. Hebrew philosophers and theologians held that the universe had not always existed, but God was the creator of the universe at some point in the past. And that is what the first verse of the Hebrew Holy Scripture states. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Eventually, what happened, though, these two contrasting views began to clash with one another, and there rose within Western philosophy an ongoing debate about whether or not the universe had a beginning. This debate played itself out among the Jews and among the Christians, Catholic and Protestant, and even among the Muslims. The Muslims are theists as well. And this debate lasted until the 18th century when, kind of at the peak of the 18th century, when there was a German philosopher named Immanuel Kant, and he's very famous. He shared his two cents, stating that there was rationally compelling arguments for both sides of the argument. Is the universe eternal and infinite, or at some point in time was it created? Well, all I can say is so much for German ingenuity there, because that's where he left it. He said there's good reasons for both, and he dropped it. But lately, there has been a resurgence in this discussion. And today, this argument is known as, and I'm gonna probably butcher the pronunciation, it's Kalam. It's called Kalam Cosmological Argument. It's so titled because its historic roots are in the medieval Islamic theology. Okay, so your pastor, you're gonna talk about Islamic theology in the Christian church? Well, as a matter of fact, I am this morning. Kalam is actually the Arabic word for which means medieval theology. And this argument was largely, which I said, was set aside back in the 18th century, is now back on the center stage and is definitely worth our consideration today as we continue to both, we want to, as Christians, defend and share our faith. And we need to have these handholds for people who are, quite frankly, unchurched, unchristian. They're goats, basically. They're out there, and they need something to grab onto to get them, to help us pull them in. As a matter of fact, in an article, this is an article from Cambridge. It's called the Cambridge, how about this? Cambridge Companion of Atheism, issued in the year 2007. They wrote something. It said this: a count of the articles, so they counted the articles in the philosophy journals, shows that more articles have been published about the Kalam cosmological argument than any other argument for God's existence. This was just back in 2007. You see, theists and atheists alike cannot leave this cosmological argument alone. It just drives people to. And you're probably going to say, I've never even heard of it. How many have ever heard of this before? Has anybody? Well, one. You know, that says something. You know, I mean, why aren't we Christians more into this sort of stuff? So what is this argument that, now, as I read this stuff, you're probably going to go, oh, I've heard of it then. I may not have known the title, but I've heard the argument before. And that's good. And I'm happy for that. But why has this argument, this cosmological argument, why has it enjoyed such a resurgence? Well, first, let's learn something about this Muslim theologian that introduced and clarified the argument. His name was, I'll probably butcher his name, Al-Ghazali. Al-Ghazali. He was a 12th century Muslim theologian from Persia, which is modern-day Iran. And he was concerned that the Muslims in his day, the Muslim philosophers of his day, were being influenced by the Greek philosophy that it was denying God's creation of the universe. See, the Greeks' mind thought was infiltrating in, even into the Muslims, and causing them to question, what, the universe, was it really created by God, or was it always there? Is it infinite? So, Ghazali, this philosopher, theologian, he started reading the reviews or reading what these other philosophers, Greek philosophers, were writing, and then he wrote a scathing report about that. And he basically came out and said that a beginningless universe is absurd. It doesn't make any sense. The universe must have a beginning, he stated. And since nothing begins to exist without a cause, there must be a transcendent creator of the universe. Excuse me. Ghazali's reasoning involves three simple steps. One, whatever begins to exist has a cause for its beginning. Whatever begins to exist has a cause to its beginning. Number two, the universe began to exist. Therefore, the universe has a cause of its beginning. That's your basic logical, three-step logical process here. Let's look at each step of this argument. We could restate the first premise as this, saying, if the universe began to exist, then the universe has a cause to its beginning. Here's three reasons why Ghazali has three points that make his first statement a very strong statement. One, something cannot come from nothing. Okay? Something cannot come from nothing. To claim that something can come from nothing is like a scientist believing in magic. If one person would deny this premise number one, then you must believe that the whole universe just appeared at some point in the past for no reason whatsoever. But when you think about it, seriously, nobody believes that things just pop out without a cause. I think we can all pretty much agree with that statement. Number two, if something can come into being from nothing, then it becomes inexplicable why just anything or everything doesn't come into being from nothing. I like the analogy that one philosopher put forth. He said, imagine you and your friend, you're in an unknown land. You're an explorer. Let's say you're explorers in some unknown land. And you come across, you're walking around, just you and your friend, and you come across a large sphere in the woods. You're walking through the woods, okay? And you ask your friend, you say, wow, look at that sphere over there. Do you think that sphere just happened to appear out of nowhere, or was there a cause behind that? And your friend will say, well, gee, this is nothing I've ever seen before. There's got to be some cause behind that, this sphere. And you go, agree. Yeah, I agree too. This something caused the sphere. It just didn't pop out of nowhere. Well, you walk a little further in this unknown land. All of a sudden, you come across a bigger sphere. And you ask your friend again. You go, where did this thing come from? Do you think it has a cause behind it? And your friend says, yeah, I mean, I don't see how this could just appear out of nowhere. I mean, something had to make that thing. This is nothing I've ever seen before. And then you walk along a little further, and all of a sudden, finally see a gigantic sphere. Same idea, same round object. And you ask the question again. How did this gigantic sphere get here? And you ask your friend, something caused this to be here. Why is it then that the same people who insist upon a creator for the small spheres, they see these things, somebody must have created those spheres. Why is it that they will continue to not deny that there is a creator of the world, which is the most magnificent sphere ever made? Because that's what our world is, isn't it? It's just one gigantic big sphere. Three, common experience and scientific evidence confirm the truth of the premise number one. The scientific method and the process of inquiry that all students in public or private school, they go to, they learn this idea that there must be a cause to an effect. That's why we do the observations. That's why we write down the numbers of the temperature when we're trying to do some lab experiment. So it's hard to understand how anyone committed to modern science could deny the premise one and say that it's more plausibly, it's more true than false. That an effect, that in a phenomena, it has a cause. The universe, it is an effect. We see it, we touch it, we feel it. What is the cause behind it? Now let's look at Ghazali's second statement of cosmological argument. This statement is more controversial than the first statement because it says that the universe began to exist. We will examine both the philosophical and the scientific evidence that support this claim. Now, I got to warn you right here, things get a little bit dicier here because we have to dive in a little bit more into philosophy and also to math. Okay, I just said it, math. Okay, that I don't know about you, but sometimes that scares people when you say math. Okay? I consider myself neither a philosopher nor a mathematician. All I have to do is go back into ninth grade and remember the mental block I had trying to learn algebra. Okay, I basically broke down in class and cried because I couldn't. I had no idea what are these letters doing in here in this math problem. Okay, and I don't think I've ever quite fully recovered from that incident, by the way. Okay, so when people start talking about this mathematical concept of infinity, my mind goes numb. But we're going to skate the surface of this idea of infinity for a second and see how it can be used as evidence for the beginning of the universe. Really, it comes down in layman's terms, and I can only give you layman's terms because my God is still working on restoring and redeeming my mind from all the TV I've watched, okay, and Gilligan's Island, okay, so I'm trying to get that out of my mind, and God's helping me do that. But Ghazali was saying basically that infinity is theoretical, but it's not actual. He argued that if the universe never began to exist and was always just there from eternity past, then there has been an infinite number of past events prior to today. An infinite number of things, he said, cannot exist. It's more theoretical than real. If an actual number of infinite things did exist, then various absurdities start to occur in reality. Here's one example he put forth, but that was put forth by a philosopher. Here is, you remember Achilles, the Greek god? I'm not promoting a mythology here, but I'm just saying, wasn't he well known for being really fast? Okay, let's say Achilles was going to race a tortoise. Okay, and Achilles said something, hey, I'm really faster than this tortoise. I'm going to let the tortoise have a head start. So he lets the tortoise go for a while before he starts up. Will Achilles ever catch the tortoise when he takes off? In reality, he will, right? Because he's really fast. And it only take him a matter of a day or so or whatever. I don't know how much time he gave the tortoise to get ahead. But he will be able to catch the tortoise. But what about this idea, if you inject infinity into that thing? No matter how fast Achilles travels, he will never catch the tortoise because there's an infinite number of points he must pass to get to the tortoise. Achilles is going to lose the race before he ever starts. Because of the infinite, you can always take the distance between Achilles and the tortoise and divide it and say, okay, he's that far away. But you can take that point, and you can divide that in half and keep dividing and dividing and an infinite number of times. And when you start thinking about that, and this hurts my head, and forgive me for hurting your head today. I don't want to hurt anybody's head, brain, but he may never catch the tortoise based on the idea of infinity. Here's another analogy. There's this thing called Hilbert's Hotel. Anybody hear of Hilbert's Hotel? In which the hotel has an infinite number of rooms. And suppose, furthermore, that all the rooms are full. So you have this huge hotel, and there's an infinite number of rooms, but all the rooms are full. Suppose, furthermore, that, now a new guest shows up at the desk and says, hey, I would like a room tonight to stay. And can you accommodate me? And the manager says, of course I can. I will just take all the people who are in there, and I'll move them down a room. So that room number one will be full because there's an infinite number of rooms, right? But so there's room for this guy, and yet all the rooms are full. How does that work? Again, this idea of absurdity in infinity. But then again, how about this? Let's say there's an infinite number of people who come to the hotel manager and say, we all need rooms tonight. But and this hotel room is already full, but there's an infinite number of rooms. He says, oh, I could accommodate all you guys. All you have to do is take every person who's in an odd number room. We're going to multiply that by two. So if he's in room number three, we're going to multiply that by two. So now he's going to have to go to room number six. That way, all the odd number rooms will now be open for all the infinite people who want to come in. It's crazy. I know, it hurt my head when I tried to understand this too. It just goes to show the point. He's trying to make the point that in theoretically, infinity is an interesting idea. But when you get down into reality, things got a little crazy on there. There was another one too, but I won't get into that one right now, but. What does this all have to do with the universe having a beginning? Well, I think it's like this. If the universe is infinite and has no beginning, then how do we all arrive at a singular point in time? Time is measured by one event occurring after another. History is a series of events, one event succeeding another. If an infinite amount of time has already elapsed in the universe, then how do we account for the fact that we are meeting here today? If there is no beginning to the universe, isn't it completely plausible that we should have met together at some other time in some other distant past or in the future? Does that make sense? Okay, I got to say this. This is the philosophical part of this discussion. I'm going to leave that alone for now. And forgive me, I probably evoked more questions than answers. But now let's look at some scientific developments from the realm of astronomy that confirmed the beginning of the universe. First, there's a strong consensus among scientists that the universe is expanding. Okay, we go back to 1917. Albert Einstein was applying his famous general theory of relativity to the universe, and he was under the impression that the universe, things were changing in the universe, things were moving and changing in the universe, but the universe as a whole was constant. You got to get that idea first in your mind, okay? But as he worked out his equations, and remember, Albert Einstein was a brilliant, incredibly brilliant, out-of-this-world person who understand mathematical equations and more than we'll ever, if all of us combined, would never understand. But as he worked out his equations, he realized something was terribly amiss. His equations described a universe that was either blowing up or contracting. And that really bothered him. And he said, what am I going to do about this? I know what I'll do. I'll make a fudge factor. I will introduce into my equations something that will help the universe kind of be static again. And so he did that. And later he confessed it was the biggest mistake of his whole career is doing that. Well, later on in 1929, Edwin Hubble, remember the Hubble telescope, it's named after Edwin Hubble, confirmed with a couple of other astronomers, the hypothesis that had already been hypothesized by Einstein's equations. And in fact, they discovered what is commonly today known as the redshift. Anybody hear about the redshift? The redshift basically says that galaxies are moving away from us and from each other. And the redshift is like the light spectrum. And if it's going to the red, that means it's kind of slowing down. Another example is the Doppler effect. Think about if you're at a race track and you're hearing the speeding race cars going around the track. As the race cars are coming towards you, you get the high-pitched sound of the race car coming towards you. But what happens after the race car passes you? What is it? Does it? The frequency goes down or becomes less, and it kind of, and they go away. Do I have to do an illustration of that? Do I? You know the meow, that sort of thing, okay? Because it's going by you, and that's what it is. That's what the astronomers saw in the sky. They didn't even know there were galaxies at first. They thought they were like nebulae or something or some sort. But then they realized these were galaxies, and they were going away. And they could see that in the red shift. They expected a certain light spectrum, and they were getting something else. And said they're going away from each other. It basically came down to the idea that the universe was expanding. Now think about that for a second. That's mind-blowing in itself, because the universe is expanding, but it's not going into some vacant place that's already there. That's not right. You think, oh, there's some place the universe is going? Well, no, it's expanding. Okay, that's going to hurt my head later too, but okay. But here's the important thing about the discovery of an expanding universe. That is, we can rewind the tape. That's what we, oh, by the way, that's what we did in the 80s when we had a VCR and a VHS. We rewound the tape. Okay, for all you millennials out there who don't understand what that's going on there. We rewind the tape and we go back to we can see the beginning. We can look at the beginning of the universe. This discovery became what is known, was the seed of what is now called the Big Bang model of the universe, which predicts an absolute beginning of the universe. If this model is correct, which most scientists agree that it is, then we have amazing scientific confirmation of the second premise of the Kalam cosmological argument, that the universe had a beginning, it is not eternal or infinite. Right now you're saying, Pastor, why didn't you say that in the first place? It took you forever to get to that point. Well, you know, of course, scientific discoveries are always provisional. We can fully expect that new theories will come out, attempting to avoid the universe's beginning. And there's been a lot, and I didn't add this into my sermon today, but you know, they can look at the different multiverses and oscillating universe, and that it continues to expand and increase, you know, contract and expand, that sort of thing. Such proposals are welcomed and tested by the Christian community, by scientists. We want to see those proposals. We want them to test them. And because it's not going, we stand firmly and confidently in our understanding of what the scripture says about there was a beginning of the universe and God created it. It's pretty clear which way the evidence points. Today, the proponents of the Ghazali cosmological argument, we are comfortably within the scientific mainstream in holding that the universe had a beginning, that it wasn't, that's not infinite, it's not eternal. Well, there's one other scientific confirmation for the beginning of the universe, and that is called the second law of thermodynamics, which basically says that the universe is winding down, okay? So in a closed system of the universe, unless somehow there's more energy put into it, you know, that's going to, it's slowly winding down. It's slowly cooling off. As a matter of fact, when it comes to the end, it's called what they call heat death. The universe will have a death because there'll be no more energy to keep it going. Now this creates another conundrum for the scientists out there that want to put forth this idea of eternal infinite universe. Because if that is the case, why isn't the universe, if there's all this time, infinite time that elapsed, why isn't the universe burned out yet? There's an infinite amount of time for it to happen. Why hasn't the universe already run out of steam since it had an infinite amount of time to do so already? That's a good question. Of course, attempts have been made to avoid the beginning of the universe as predicted by the second law of thermodynamics, but none of them have been successful up to this point. So once again, on the basis of the philosophical and the scientific evidence, we have good grounds for believing that the universe began to exist. It therefore follows that the universe has a cause for its beginning, which is Ghazali's third point in his three-step thing. Since the universe is here, there has to be a cause behind the universe's existence. And this leads us to the very important question, what properties must the cause have to make the effect being the universe? What is that cause going to look like? Well, this cause, first of all, must be uncaused. It must be uncaused. It must be, because if it was, because if the cause was caused, well, then we just keep going back and back and back, trying to go back to, you know. But this cause must be uncaused. It must transcend space and time, since it created space and time. It must be immaterial and non-physical. It must be unimaginably powerful, since it created both all the matter and energy. And finally, Ghazali argued that this uncaused first cause must also be a personal being endowed with the freedom of will to do that, to create the universe. Now, one philosopher gave this example to help us explain, and it was the best one I could come, you know, as I read, this one seemed to be one that I could try to get my head around here. He says, if the cause for water freezing is a temperature of 32 degrees or below. He actually used Celsius, but I changed it to Fahrenheit. Then ice is the result, or it's the effect. The cause is the temperature, a certain temperature. The effect is ice. Whatever the cause is, the temperature then ice is the effect. If the cause is timeless, so then too would be the effect. This is an impersonal example of a cause and effect. Okay? So wherever the temperature, there's going to be ice. They'll be there at the same time, right? The temperature and the ice, same time. That's impersonal. And we're talking about a personal creator, the personal cause being God. But God, the first cause, is personal and has freedom of will. The effect, in other words, the universe isn't there just because the cause is. Not like the temperature and the ice. The universe isn't there at the same time as God. This makes God personal. Think of it this way. God existed alone without the universe. Changeless and timeless was God, is God. His free act of creation is a temporal event simultaneous with the universe coming into being. Therefore, God enters into time when he creates the universe. God is thus timeless without the universe, but he breaks into time when he creates the universe. The Kalam cosmological argument, it gives powerful grounds for believing in the existence of a beginningless, uncaused, timeless, spaceless, changeless, immaterial, enormously powerful, personal creator of the universe. And guess what? His name is Jesus. Colossians chapter 1, verse 16 through 17. Paul writes, "For by him all things were created, things in heaven and on earth, visible and invisible. Whether thrones or powers or rulers or authorities, all things were created for him and by him. He is before all things, and in him all things hold together." Again, if you want to read more about that, you can Google and the Kalam cosmological argument for the evidence of God. It's fascinating reading. There's a lot of it out there. Some of it is, you know, for dummies. That's what I started with, you know, looked at that. But you can work your way up as you want to dig more into it. But it's fascinating because, again, people who are out there, outside the church, they need something we need to pull them in a little bit. And this is one way we can do it, by saying, you know, hey, there's a beginning of the universe. Oh, yeah, okay, I believe in the beginning of the universe. Well, then from there, you can say, well, there's a cause. Since this universe is here, there's got to be and the universe is an effect, there's a cause behind the effect. And how we can show that cause can be the personal God that's spoken about in the Bible. So, I'm here to edify the church. I'm here to edify you. And the Bible helps us do that. And truth, scientific truth, can also be used as a tool to witness to people. So think about that this week, and I hope I stretched your brain just a little bit this morning. Appreciate that.